start recording as well. So today's topic is almost exclusively automatic proof procedures. And first, I want to introduce you to a particularly important one that you have already seen, but only in the guise of the auto proof method, and that's underneath for a large part, it relies on simplification. And so I should explain how simplification works, because otherwise it's hard for you to understand what the system's doing. I think now I need to focus on it. And then, so what does simplification mean? It means that you use equations and you use them only from left to right. So, of course, logically, you can use them in both directions, but operationally, the search procedure will not use them in the other direction. And it'll use them as long as possible, and that's in red because, of course, that has the potential for divergence. So that's up to you. If you give the system lots of simplification rules, then it may get into a loop. We'll talk about that later. And terminology, to emphasize the fact that these equations are only used in one direction, they are often called simplification rules. Simplification is the same as something called term rewriting or rewriting, so I'll also call them rewrite rules. And simplification rules may be a bit of a misnomer in the sense that the term may actually become larger, but it should always become simpler in some sense, although that sense may not always be apparent. Again, we'll talk about that later. And here's a simple example of term rewriting or equation simplification. And so we assume we have these four equations that the system knows about. This is the formula that we start with and that we want to simplify with the help of these four equations. So let's just go through the rows, and you can tell me which of the four equations is applicable to the current formula. So, yeah. Equation 2 is indeed applicable. You could apply equation 2 at that point here, right? Yeah. Is that the only one?
No, we could maybe apply equation 1 on the left hand side.
Right. So let's do that. Equation 1 on the left hand side. That collapses down to success of 0. So that by equation 1, this formula is simplified to this formula. And now we can use equation 2, as was suggested, because the right-hand side is still the same. So we can replace the left-hand side here, match that against this term, and replace it by the right-hand side. That means we pull the successor out and we get, by equation 2, we get this term. So now, how can we continue? What's the next possible equation to apply?
We can apply equation 3.
Yep, because we have a successor on both sides of the less than or equal, and so we can just drop the successor and get an equivalent less than or equal condition. And then now, of course, there's just one more possibility. You can now use equation 4, and 0 less than or equal any natural number is always equivalent to true, so you can rewrite this to true. Although you could have done something else as well, you could still have simplified this term first to using this equation and simplified this to x. But in the end, you would have always used equation 4 with the 0 on the left-hand side of the less than or equal and reduced it to true. And so it's not clear when the system simplifies formulas in which order it's going to do it. It'll do it in some order, you shouldn't rely on a particular order, but It'll do it consistently, so it'll not change its mind from today to tomorrow, although with a new release it might change its mind, and so sometimes proofs break when some system internals change because they were too brittle and you relied too much on a particular strategy. Now there's more. There's also conditional rewriting, so you can use not just equations for rewriting, but also conditional equations where the equation left equals right has a number of preconditions, P1 to PK. And how does that work? The principle is that this equation, L is replaced by R, is only applicable if all the preconditions can be proved, again, recursively by simplification. So the simplification process is recursive as soon as you have a conditional equation. It'll also try to prove the conditions with the same machinery of simplification. But only if all the conditions have been proved, then the equation is used. And here is an example. You assume you have these two rewrite rules. P of 0 rewrites to true, and f of x rewrites to g of x if P of x can be proved. And then let's look at two examples. If you look at the term f of 0, then you can indeed simplify that to g of 0. Why? Because, well, you try to use this equation here, then you first have to prove P of 0, because you're applying it here, and P of 0 is indeed reducible to true, so that works. So you can reduce or simplify f of 0 to g of 0. If, on the other hand, you try to simplify f of 1, then it just wouldn't work, because you would then have to prove P of 1, but there is no equation around that reduces P of 1 to 0 to true, so it'll just get stuck and will not use that equation. So this is important because it can lead into trouble. Simplification rules may not terminate, and the simplifier applies them more or less blindly. Not completely blindly, but it just looks at it very locally. And so here's an example. If you give it those two rewrite rules, it will not terminate. It'll just go around in a loop forever. And so it's up to you to make sure that you don't get into those loops. And there's a general principle, but it's not automatic. It can't be automatic. And the principle is that if you have such a conditional equation, then this is suitable as a simplification rule under the assumption that the left-hand side, L, is bigger in some sense than both the right-hand side and the preconditions. If you can guarantee that, then you're okay. But the question, of course, is what means bigger? It doesn't have to mean syntactically bigger. It has to be some abstract mathematical idea that something gets simpler. So you go from something big to something simpler, but what exactly is simpler? That's not so easy to say in general. If you're in a functional programming context, then typically the equations that you write are very often terminating functional programs, and then you're not in a you don't have any problem here. If you're in a more mathematical context, arguing about group theory and rings and fields, then it's not so easy. In our case, we shouldn't worry about it too much. But just to make sure that you understood the principle, why does L have to be bigger than both R and the preconditions? Because you're starting out with L, and then first you have to prove the preconditions. So you shouldn't have to prove something that's more complicated than what you start with. Otherwise, you get into a recursive. You may get into an infinite recursion, and then you continue with R, so you should continue with something that's smaller, otherwise, again, you might continue forever. And so here's an example. If you look at these two conditional rewrite rules, then one of them is suitable as a simplification rule in this sense here, that it satisfies this principle, and the other one is not suitable. And so look at it for a moment. So who thinks the first one is a suitable rewrite rule? Yes, one, two. Who doesn't think so? Why do you think it doesn't? It's not a good idea to use the first rewrite rule?
The second one where you get to remove the succession function. The left-hand side is larger in the sense that...
Sorry, I'm asking about the first one. You're telling me about the second one?
Yeah, the first one...
Sorry, what gets more complicated? We look at this rewrite rule. What's more complicated than what?
The right-hand side is more complicated than the left-hand side.
The right-hand side is true. Oh, what do you mean? This is L, is this term here. True is R, is this term. And the only P1 is this term. Well, it turns out this is actually perfectly okay, because as two of you gathered, this left-hand side is indeed bigger than this one, purely syntactically. You have another successor here, one more successor there than in the precondition, and it's certainly bigger than this one, because here you're at the end of the simplification chain. You can't simplify true any further. What about the other one? What about the second one? Any comments on that one? It's again what?
Recursive.
What do you mean it's recursive? Is it suitable or is it not suitable?
It's not suitable.
But then it's not again recursive, it's not suitable. The first one was suitable. Who thought the first one was unsuitable? You did? No?
I thought it was
okay. Huh?
I thought the first one was okay.
Yeah, but he seemed to say, because he said again recursive, so that indicated to me that. So the first one, then let me just say, this one is not okay because under the left hand side is not bigger than one of the preconditions. This precondition here is clearly a larger precondition because it's got one more formula, one more function symbol in it. So if you try to do this, you get into an infinite regress, because once you have a term of this kind, then if you try to simplify this term recursively, it's just a bigger term, and you can keep on going always using this equation and always getting back into a precondition that's even bigger. Yep.
I thought we wanted to simplify preconditions.
Yes, the precondition is this one here. Well, we want to simplify the whole thing here down to true, or this one down to true. And what this rewrite rule does, it actually does get rid of a successor function. This one gets rid of a successor function on the greater side of the symbol, and it tries to solve an equation. It tries to solve a condition that's simpler than the one that we started. So this is the template that you should always keep in mind when you have conditional equations. Don't make the conditions any more complicated than what you start with on the left-hand side of the equation. This may be a bit confusing because this is also a binary symbol. So when I say left-hand side, I typically mean the left-hand side of the equation and not the left-hand side of this less-than symbol. Any last questions on this? Then let's be let's introduce this SIMP proof method, which I believe has already been shown in the tutorials, but here it's a more systematic presentation. So if you have a goal of this form here, now the P1 to Pn have got nothing to do with the rewrite rules. They are preconditions in your goal, and this is the conclusion you're trying to show. And you then issue this command, which means you apply the simplification method, and you locally add some previously proved equations as new rewrite rules in that proof step. Then what happens, the proof method will simplify both the assumptions here in your subgoal and the conclusion. And what will it use to do that? It will use all the lemmas that you proved previously that you gave this, in square brackets, SIMP attribute. It will also use all the rules of your function definitions. So all the equations you gave in function definitions will be used in the simplification process. And rules from the data type. Remember, the data type definition has rules like zero is not successor and stuff like that. So there are some simplification rules that come out of data type definitions as well. And it will also use these lemmas that you've given explicitly. And finally, it will use the assumptions here to simplify, of course, to use them, use the assumptions to simplify the conclusion, but it will also use the assumptions to simplify each other. So those assumptions are used to simplify one another and to simplify the conclusion. Yeah.
What's the difference between applied SIMP, this one, and what we use in the exercise where we wrote by SIMP?
Oh, apply is just one step. By claims, I also prove the by claims to prove the subgoal completely, whereas apply just say do it and there may be something left over.
So this is just for simplification. We get a new equation and we don't do anything with it. We just simplify the original.
Yes. It's just one proof steps among many, and the by always finishes. More questions? Right, so there are variations there. Instead of adding rewrite rules, you can also locally delete rewrite rules, and you don't have to. You can just say apply SIMP and not do anything, what neither add nor delete. Oops. And the comparison of auto and SIMP, they are... there are certain differences, namely auto acts on all the subgoals. That's one of the few proof methods that acts on all subgoals. SIMP, as the majority of the proof methods, acts only on subgoal 1. And auto is a superset of SIMP. So auto will do lots of simplification, but it will do more, and I'll get to talk what else it does later on. And you can similarly simplify the auto method, you can modify the auto proof method. This looks a bit confusing, the syntax. So this is the proof method, and SIMP add is the modifier. Why do we suddenly need to say SIMP add, and why can't we just say add? Like on the previous slide here, we just say SIMP, that's the proof method, and then we modified it by adding stuff to it. The point is that auto, if you were just to write add here, it wouldn't know what kind of proof rule you want to add, because auto knows about more things than just equations. And so you have to say, please add this simplification rule or delete this simplification rule. So the SIMP is another modifier of the modifier, so to speak. So these two belongs together when you say auto. And one thing that comes in useful from time to time when you want to rewrite with not a lemma that you've proved, but with a definition that you have made, functions are applied automatically. If you define something with fun, it will be used automatically. But if you define something with definition, that's just a non-recursive definition, then you have to explicitly add that to your simplification rule. Then you have to say simp add. And if you want to simplify with the definition of function f, then the name of that thing, that equation, is f underscore def. So that will simplify with the definition, basically unfold. The definition will replace the f by the body that the f stands for. Okay. Now here comes a, a frequently useful further modification of the simplification process. And this is quite useful in particular in a functional programming context. And this is what happens automatically during simplification. When you have a big proposition P and inside you have an if then else, then at some stage in the rewriting process, more precisely, the simplifier will try to simplify things as long as possible. And if it can't go any further, then it'll pick an if then else and expand that if then else into the two possible cases. So this proposition here will be replaced by two propositions. One is the implication that under the assumption that the if case is true, you have to prove P of S, where S is the result of the then branch. And under the assumption not A, you have to prove P of T, so the whole formula where the that if then else is collapsed down to the T, to the else branch. So this can be very helpful, case distinction often, because now when you continue the simplification process and you again go into that P, which may be some big formula, then you now have another local assumption, the A, and here you have another local assumption, not A, and that may help to prove the then and the else part. So this can be quite helpful. On the other hand, it can also blow up your proof goal, because you have two copies of the P now, and one where the if-then-else is replaced by S, and one it's been replaced by T. And so in particular, if you have multiple if-then-elses, this may really blow up your goal. If at the end most of what's left over has been proved, then you're happy, but of course it can be that it's just a big mess. Then you have to think again what to do. So in most cases, this is a helpful idea, but not always. This can be generalized, and then it's no longer automatic, namely not just to if-then-elses, but also to case expressions. So here's an example of something you have to do by hand. If you have some big proposition P, and inside you have a case expression over some expression E, whatever it may be, and here, for the sake of concreteness, I've used a case expression where E is a natural number, and if E is zero, then you return A, and otherwise you return B. And you can also split this formula up into this formula, where you may have two cases. If E is zero, you have to prove P of A, and if E is suck of N, then you have to prove P of B, and you have to locally quantify the N, because the N is not something known yet, it's a locally created variable. If E is of the form suck of N for all N, then this. So again, you're making a kind of case distinction. What is the form of the expression E? But this is not done automatically, because it can lead to non-termination. Whereas this, as far as termination is concerned, is harmless, but it can just blow up your formula. So how do you do this if it's not done automatically? You have to, again, modify the simplifier. So you call the simplifier and you modify it and you say, please split, and this is short for saying, please split all case expressions over natural numbers. So this is a fairly undirected modifier. Yeah, it just tells you which type you should split case expressions over. And if there are multiple case expressions, you can't say, I want to split this one but not that one. The only thing you can differentiate, you can say, I want to split everything to do with natural numbers, but not and only that. And if there are other case expressions to do with lists, then those will be left intact.
Yeah. Do you, for example, have a tree in there in the case expression? Would you then only need that? Could you then call some split method?
This also works for auto. And the general form, if you have an arbitrary data type T, then you would have to say, instead of nat.split, you would have to say T.split, where T is the name of the data type. So tree.split would be the right modifier. And we will see examples of that again later on. But this is really helpful because typically in functional programs you get if then else and you get case expressions, and then it may be necessary to say to the synthesizer, please split the case expression into the two possible or whatever, into all these possible cases, and then it'll do that automatically rather than you having to do it. And there's a special situation if you have pairs. So you will sometimes see or write formulas like this. Let the pair xy be equal to t in some expression u that depends on x and y. So t may be some function call that returns a pair, and here you're explicitly taking the pair apart. You say, I give that pair the name x and y, so I now can I get my hands on the x and the y inside the in expression. So that is the typical way of writing it. Another way of writing it, and actually the system will change this way into this way of writing it, but it's exactly the same thing logically. You say case t, and t is something of pair type, case t of, and then if it's a pair consisting of the components x and y, then you return you evaluate it to the value u with x and y inside. So these are logically equivalent ways of writing the same thing. You're just taking something of pair type apart so you can get your hands on the two subparts of the pair. And how do you deal with this? You again will have to somehow split this pair to really get your hands on the two subcomponents. And this is the way, this is how a proof of such a proposition should continue. You should transform this into, well, if T is really equal to that pair, then you have to prove P. P is this outside big context that this whole expression sits in, then you have to prove P, but now of the value that was the result of the sub-expression, the value U of X, Y. And now you've really locally introduced your X and Y. And so this is what you would ideally like your these two expressions to be replaced by in the simplification process, and you have to say so explicitly if you want to do that. Then you have to say split and split the product type. This is why it's called prod.split. So it again follows this synonym. You have to give the name of the type and dot split. And here the type is the pair type is called internally prod. So I'm mentioning this, and it will come up frequently whenever you deal with pairs. If you don't deal with pairs, you don't have to know about this, but otherwise it will be necessary. And now let's go and look at a demo of what you've seen. Right. So these are just a few simple examples to show how the simplifier behaves. So the first one, this lemma, of course, this is not a provable lemma. Auto-quick-check found a counterexample. It just shows you what happens. So what will happen if you simplify it? The only thing that you can really simplify is this part of the formula and the background theory of the simplifier knows about the fact that appending the empty list to the right doesn't do anything. So if you simp, you say apply simp, then it simplifies your original goal to this simpler goal, ys is equal to the empty list, which of course isn't true for all ys. So, and this oops here is just something you can put in a theory file that will abandon a proof and say, well, this proof didn't actually work. So it's different from sorry. Sorry says, I believe this theorem is true. I don't want to continue proving it. Oops means, oh, this was a proof attempt that didn't work. And I don't, maybe the formula isn't even true. And here is a more complicated example. Yep, you can just see the right end. So this one is actually provable, and it's a bit of a cooked up example. Oh, no. So, can somebody, or maybe we just go through the rows and start with you. What do you think the simplifier will do? It, you don't have to know in exactly what order, but how would you start?
I would look at the preconditions and try to figure out the reason.
Yes, so which one?
I'll start from left to right, mm-hmm. And then we have xs appended to zs is equal to ys appended to xs.
Yeah.
Which means, and then we have another precondition that says
this
the
one.
Empty list, yes, the empty list appended to xs is an empty list appended to an empty list, which means that xs should be an empty list.
Exactly. So that will be the first step. This whole equation will get simplified. Here you simplify this to x's. Here you simplify this to the empty list. So you have, as a result of this, you have x's equal to the empty list. So let's stop at that and let's ask your neighbor in the row above. How would you continue from that? Mm-hmm.
So now that this knows that x's is the empty list, you can put the empty list as x's in the first equation. So you have
right.
The empty list.
Right, and so what's the result of simplifying this under the knowledge of that x's is empty?
When you have zs equals ys.
Yep, that's exactly it. And so once you know that zs is equal to ys, you can replace zs in the conclusion by ys, and then you have ys equals ys, which is true. So this is just an example to show you that the simplification process may first do some steps in the preconditions, in the assumptions, and then derive some information from that to do something in the conclusion. This is an example of adding rewrite rules. So there is a list of rewrite rules designed for algebraic simplifications called algebra simps. And this is a typical example of using it. I will actually say more about algebraic proofs in a moment, so we don't need to spend too much time on that. Let me see why we actually need this. If you just say apply simp, this equation will not be proved. Why not? Because by default, the simplifier does not use distributivity, because distributivity blows up your term, and you don't always want this to happen. Things can become either very large or unrecognizable. So if I remove this, if I just say apply simp here, it'll actually say failed to apply proof method. It couldn't do anything at all. It couldn't simplify that term at all. There's no built-in rewrite rule or default rewrite rule that will do something, but once you use distributivity and some other rules that are all in algebra SIMPs, then things work out. So algebra SIMPs will feature more prominently later on. And yeah, if you feel that algebra SIMPs is important in some context, then you can also make it permanently part of the simplification set. And then it'll always be applied by SIMP and auto and friends. So this is what this declare line does. It gives something, some lemmas that you've previously proved, a new attribute, in this case the SIMP attribute, because algebra SIMPs, although the name suggests it, but it's not a default rewrite rule. It's helpful in many circumstances, but also can be quite confusing. And here's an example of rewriting with definitions. Here you have the square function. So square of n is just n times n, square of a natural number. And then you want to prove that the square of n times n is the same as the square of n times the square of n. And if you want to prove that, you have to use the definition of square, and you just add that explicitly, otherwise it will not be added. So definitions are some kind of abstraction barrier, which is not unfolded automatically, which you have to say, I want to see what's inside. And now we come to these splitting examples. So here, this theorem, this lemma is proved automatically. Why? So A and B is equivalent with if A, then B, else false. And the fact that this is proved automatic is due to the case distinction that goes on internally. So if you try to simplify things, well, you can't simplify A and B any further. You can't simplify A, you can't simplify B, you can't simplify false. So everything is as simplified as possible. And then the system makes a case distinction. Okay, here is the thing to make a case distinction on the A. So one case is A is true. Then the right-hand side becomes B. And the left-hand side, we now have A and B under the assumption that we know A is true. And under that assumption, true and B collapses down to B, and then we have B equals to B, which is fine. And then there's the other case where A is equal to false, then the right-hand side is the false, and the left-hand side, well, you now have A and B under the assumption not A, so not A means A rewrites to false, and false and B rewrites to false, so you get false equal to false. So this is an example where it actually helps you to prove something that if you didn't do that splitting wouldn't be easily provable. And here's an example. Oh, right, here this just shows you what... So this is not a provable theorem. That's just a demo for the result of the simplification process. So this is the formula that you're trying to prove, if A, then B, else C, which in general isn't provable, but just to see what happens if you apply the simplifier, then you get these two, this conjunction of these two formulas, one prove that B is true under A and not C is true under not C, not A. And finally, an example where you have to do things where you have to explicitly instruct the simplifier to do the splitting. This is actually a true formula. One is greater or equal than this case expression. Why? Well, if you look inside the case expression, then one arm, if ns is the empty list, returns a 1, and 1 is certainly greater or equal to 1, and the other arm returns a successor of something, but a successor of something is always greater or equal to 1, because it's at least 1. So this is a true formula, but the only way you can prove this is by enabling the case splitting, and that's exactly what this line, or this modifier here says. It says, please, inside the current proof goal, try to split all the case expressions over lists. And then, yeah, the result isn't terribly instructive. It just says no subgoals. But you're always relieved when you see that. Yep.
The reason you split over lists is because you know NS is a list.
That's by the type. It's a typed language, so by the fact that you have written the empty list here, and the fact that you've written a cons here, the NS must be a list. So the type inference will automatically determine that. So if you were to hover over it, it would hopefully, I don't know. Oh yeah, now it tells you it's a free variable of nat list type. Yeah. And if you were to write something like zero here, then the type checker would already complain and say, this doesn't make sense to me, because in one branch you have a number and in the other branch you have a list. Any other questions? Right. Then let's take a break here, and later on we come back to proofs about arithmetic. Oh, actually, no. No, I think that should be... No, let's go on. Yeah. Actually, that's not perfectly synchronized, the two demos. This just tells you that the simplifier also knows a little bit about linear arithmetic. That means formulas which do not contain multiplication. That's the first approximation. We will say more about linear arithmetic later on, but here's just a simple example that doesn't look like simplification at all, because there's no equation in there, and indeed it has nothing to do with simplification. It's just that it's good to have a basic knowledge of linear arithmetic in all cases, and the simplifier has that basic knowledge and happens to apply it here. And this is just, you can stare at it for a little bit and maybe it immediately becomes obvious to you. Maybe you have to think about it for a moment, but it is actually a consequence. The x is less than y is a consequence of these two inequations. And the simplifier discovered that. How it did that is a different matter. It has anything to do with simplification. It's just, in fact, a built-in decision procedure to do with linear arithmetic. And finally, if you want to see what the simplifier does, you can do so by adding this using simptrace before the call to the simplifier. It works well for small examples. For large examples, it'll give you a lot of tracing information, it may be just as confusing or even more confusing than just staring at the example longer and figuring out why it didn't work. Because typically you want to see a trace when things didn't work out, and you want to see why didn't it do what I expected it to do. If you go here, the apply simp, then it will give you this trace. One thing I should say about the trace, most of it is self-explanatory, but in the beginning of the trace, you have in square brackets a number that's the depth of the simplification, because remember, if you have a conditional rewrite rule, it'll first try recursively to simplify the conditions before it applies the rule, and then it can go down a couple of levels in this simplification of preconditions until it actually solved one, and this is telling you how deep down it was. Nothing much happens. It always stays at level one because there are no conditional rules involved. And it just tells you that in how it rewrote. In the end, of course, if you look at the end result, you get false, because the reverse of the singleton list is again the singleton list, and that's not equal to the empty list. And this just gives you the step-by-step computation of how that worked. It uses a certain rewrite rule, and so in the first step it'll rewrite ref of the singleton list to ref of the empty list, and with the singleton x at the end, and so on. I don't want to go through it. So that's something, if you're really desperate, you can find out what the simplifier is doing. Right, that's really the end of this demo, and we go back to the slides. Didn't want that. I want this one, yep. And now we actually come to a little case study, binary search trees. and it'll demonstrate some things that go easily and some other things that don't go quite so easily. Mm-hmm. And again, the files are online. So BST demo. And, oh, right, I shouldn't have opened it right away. There were some more slides to show you. It builds on a tree library, and I will briefly talk you through that library. And it uses some stuff that we haven't seen yet, but we will see in a moment. But it's so simple, I can just mention it. So we are now using the type of sets here. So A set is the set of elements over type A, and we are using operations like element in a set or the union of sets, and they're all well known from mathematics, so I don't need to say anything about them. And we are also using bounded quantification. For all elements A in the set big A, some proposition P is true. And luckily, the proof method auto knows a little bit about sets, so it can deal with sets to a certain degree. And the tree library that we're building on, you import in that manner. That's the key line to start with. And what you get when you import that, you get quite a bit of stuff, but this is where you can find the actual file. The system will find it automatically for you. And what is inside, I will just mention the most important functions for our purposes here. First we start off, it defines a data type of binary trees, and these binary trees will stay with us for at least half, for the whole course, actually. They come up again and again. So what is a tree over type A? It's either a leaf, or it's a node with a left subtree and a right subtree and an element in the middle. And we use a bit of, or the system, I typically tend to type this, but the system shows me the abbreviation, open angular brackets, close angular brackets. And similarly, the node will be displayed like this, which is a bit more compact and more readable. But you can always type this if you don't know how to type this. And then there are a number of predefined functions. First, there's a size function that maps a tree into a natural number, and it's just the number of nodes in a tree. And so the size of the empty tree of the leaf is 0, and the size of a node is the size of the two subtrees plus 1. And there is also the height, which is defined almost in the same manner, except that here we don't have the addition of the heights, but here in the recursive case, we have the maximum of the heights of the two subtrees plus 1. And the height of the leaf is again 0. And then the set of elements in a tree, that is called set tree. So remember, the set function just takes... the set function, just briefly into that, takes a list into a set. The set tree function takes a tree into a set. That, of course, is also quite clear. The leaf is just the empty set of elements. If you have a node, you recursively collect the elements in the left and the right subtree, and you take the union with the element A that is here in that node. And finally, we need the in-order listing that takes a tree and gives you, rather than a set of its elements, it gives you a list of the elements in order. So the leaf is the empty list, and the node is the first the list on the left, then the element in the middle, and then the list on the right. So all of these are well-known functions from on trees. And one final one that we need, and that's quite important, is the binary search tree invariant. What does it mean that the tree is a binary search tree? Well, the following predicate tells us. So it takes a tree and gives us a Boolean, and this is how it's defined. Of course, the empty tree is a binary search tree. And when is a node a binary search tree? Well, if and only if the left and the right subtree are both binary search trees, and also for all elements in the left subtree L, X, the element, for all elements X in the left subtree, that X must be less than the element in the middle, and for all elements in the right subtree, that those elements X must be bigger than the element in the middle. Yeah.
Doesn't it make more sense for the invariant to take a comparison function?
That is more general what you're suggesting, but it's slightly less convenient. And so here I haven't gone for most generality, I've gone for compactness of the definition.
This won't work for type A, any type A, this will only work for numbers.
So you're stealing my thunder. So, yes, indeed, this is not going to work for any type A. It'll only work for numbers. Now, that's not quite correct, but the fact is we are implicitly using a feature of the Isabel type system here that is called type classes. So this is also fairly generic. It'll work for any type A that has a less than a relation on it. And that is part of the type system. In the type system, you can express this. What are Isabel's type classes on one slide? A type class, what is that? It's defined by a set of required functions, the interface to that type class. So a type class is a collection of types. And a type belongs to a type class if it provides all the functions in the interface of that type class. And also, because we're in a theorem prover and not just in a programming language, a type class is not just defined by the interface of the things that types of that class must have, but also it must each class can have a set of axioms about the functions. In our case, what we will expect is that the ordering on the elements of the tree is actually a total ordering. So that's a logical mathematical requirement. And so here is the example. There is a predefined class lin order, and those are linear orders that provide the functions less than or equal and the function less than. So if you have a type that has those two functions and is linear in the sense that it's a total ordering, then it will be in that type class, or you can tell the system it's in that type class, and then this EST predicate is applicable. So it is fairly generic. It doesn't just work for numbers, but it uses this additional type class mechanism. And as I said, when does a type belong to a class? It belongs there if the interface functions are defined on that type and they satisfy the axioms of the class. In this case, the linearity condition on the ordering. And if a type is in that class, here you need to, of course, that may need a proof to show that the axioms are satisfied. If you have proof to the system that a type belongs to a certain class, this notation is either a statement, this type belongs to this class, or it's a requirement, this type has to be of this class. It's a requirement, the type of the BST function is in fact this type. This is the precise type. It says it takes a tree over any type A that is a linear order, and it returns a Boolean. So this is a local local requirement on our type variable A that has to be true throughout this type here. It must be a linear order. So if you apply the BST function, you can apply it to any tree over a type that is known to be a linear order. So all the numbers are known to be linear orders, but you could have more complicated types also that are linear orders. So this will, we will not require type classes very much, except for this one, because we will frequently be dealing with linear orders and with functions over trees where the elements are of linear orders. So that's basically all you need to know, that in that case, if something is of type, if the type here is in the class linear order, then you can rely on the fact that you have these two functions available on that type. Questions about this basic understanding of type classes?
Yep. What's the difference between generics in Java, and type classes?
I'm not 100% sure how to compare those two. I can tell you that they might be the same. These type classes are a subset of the type classes in Haskell, and they are very different from classes in Java, but they might be very similar to generics. I'm not 100% sure. So let me pass on that one. But it's certainly, there is some genericity going on here. Yeah. And now we can actually start with the demo, unless there are further questions about the type classes. Yes, there we are. So here we do load this tree library. This is actually a bit of a different syntax. I told you the, this is probably the syntax that you should be, well, it doesn't matter. Both syntaxes that you saw on the slide and this one will work. It's just different. And this one is typically helpful that you will always want to expand let definition. So if you have let x equals a in b, then the simplifier will always expand this if you have given it that declaration. And in a functional programming context, that is typically what you want. It's not on by default, so if I switch it off, then the lets will not be expanded, but it can be quite convenient to have it on. And then we have two functions that I want to look at, the isIn function that tests if an element in the, is in a tree. So it takes a tree over a linearly ordered type. It takes an element of type of that those elements in the tree, and it gives you back a Boolean. And, of course, nothing is in a leaf. And if you're in a node, if you want to check if element X is in a node, well, you have to compare it with the with the element in that node, and if x is less than a, you have to recurse in the left branch, and otherwise, if it's bigger than a, you have to recurse in the right branch, and otherwise, we know it's true. Why do we know that? Yeah?
There's only one case left, which has to be...
Why is there only one case left?
Because it's either small, greater, smaller...
But how do we know that? Where does that come from? Right, because it's a linear order. Yeah. And then we have an insertion function, which is also equally straightforward, that takes an element from linear order, a tree, and gives you back a new tree with that element added to it in the right place, of course. And if you add an element and the tree is just a leaf, it's just the empty tree, then you have to build a node with a single element in it and two empty trees. And otherwise, you can get the same case distinction and you either recurse on the left or the right. And if, of course, after you come back, you have to rebuild the tree. So you have to build another node, and the right subtree stays the same in case we're recursing on the left and we just insert X on the left, and the tree we get out of that one replaces the original tree. And similarly, for if X is greater than A, then we have to recurse on the right. And if X is equal to A, well, then we don't have to change anything. We just return that node as it was. questions about those functions? Right. Then let's try and prove a bit of functional correctness of this implementation. And here is a first property that we would want to have, namely that if T is a binary search tree, then the isIn test is equivalent to the mathematical elementhood in this set of elements. So this projects a tree onto the set of elements in the tree, and that this asks, is that element in there? And that's very different from executing the search function, except that we can prove, syntactically it's different, but you can prove that it's the same under the assumption that it's a binary search tree. And the proof is not terribly surprising. It's an induction on the tree because all the functions involved here are simply defined by recursion on the trees and really by primitive recursion. So induction and auto will do very nicely here. And that is one of the correctness properties for the isIn function. What about the insert function? What correctness property would you expect for the insert function?
If we insert an element into a binary search tree, it should still be a binary search tree.
Right. That's something that is preservation of the invariant, indeed. That's something when you have an invariant like a binary search tree, then it should be preserved by all the functions that modify the tree. Of course, isIn doesn't modify it. What about the functional correctness? How should insert work? I mean, what should we know about the result of insert?
After inserting an element in the tree, it should be in the tree afterwards.
Right, but we can express this a bit more generically. Here you've just expressed a very specific property about that one element being in there. If you try to formulate it with the set tree function, you can explain it more succinctly. And that tells you both that X is now in it, but it also tells you that otherwise you have exactly the same elements as you had before. So this is, we will speak about this in more detail later on. This is just to show you that it's usually a good idea to express these specifications on the level of sets directly. And this is the one we just talked about. Yeah. And again, it's induction and auto. Everything works very well here. And finally, the preservation of the invariant. Here, we need to prove that after the correctness. So let's see. So here is the preservation of the invariant. If something is a binary search tree and you insert an element, you get again a binary search tree. And let's see what happens if we didn't add the set of tree lemma that we have proved up there. Here we're using it. Why are we using it? Let's take it out and let's look at the output. Let's look at what's left over after auto did its business. And here you can now see it's a complicated formula with lots of assumptions, but here is one assumption that immediately sticks out, at least to the trained eye. It says that some element XA is in set tree of insert of something. And we needed the previous lemma to then get to the point that XA must be in the union of X and the elements in T2, and that actually will then auto will trigger a case distinction. It's either, if it's in the union, must be either in that part or that part, and by that case distinction, the proofs can be completed. So far everything worked very well. Now let's look, be a bit more ambitious, and define the deletion function. So how is deletion defined? Let me see. Right, there we are. This is the deletion function. Let's look at that one. Well, if you want to delete an element from the empty tree, you just return the empty tree. If you want to delete it from a node, there are the easy recursive cases. If the element is less than the element in the node, you recurse on the left, delete it from the left subtree. Otherwise, you delete it from the right subtree. The only tricky part is if you want to delete an element in a node, because then that element is missing and you have to do something. And so what do? We basically do this. I mean, this is really all undergraduate material, but oops, where's the chalk? Oh, there. So you're here, you have your X, the A in the middle, and then you have your two subtrees, L and R, and of course you can't just take the A away if you want to delete it. What you do is, if this is a big subtree, then you take, no, not that one. If this is a big subtree, then you just take the element here and move it up here, because that is the one that should be in this place, because it's the minimum element of this subtree. And so, of course, you can only do this if the subtree is non-empty. And that's what this case distinction does. If the right subtree is a leaf, well then, no problem. If this is a leaf and you want to remove this, you can just return that. And if it's not a leaf, then you call the split min function, which is defined further up. You split off from the right subtree, you split off the minimal element, call it A prime, and you, so the split min function returns two things. It returns a pair, the minimal element, and the remaining subtree after you've split the minimal element off that subtree. And that's what the split min function does up there. Of course, there's no clause for the empty tree because you can't split an empty tree. But if you have a node, then you just keep on going down the left spine until you hit a leaf. That's exactly what you have here. If you have a node LAR, if L is already a leaf, well, then that's great. Then you can just return AR. That is then already the split is there. And otherwise, you have to continue on the left subtree, on the left branch, you split the left branch into a minimal element and the remainder, and then you return that minimal element that you just got from the recursive call, and you take the remainder of L, the L prime, and put it back into your node LAR, instead of the L. So it's a recursion that finds you along the left branch, along the left spine, finds you down here, the minimum element, and returns it all with a modified subtree where that element has been split off. And now let's try and prove something about this function. And this will not be quite so easy. And in fact, I won't prove anything about delete. I will prove right away something about split min. We will go, because we will need split min in order to prove anything about the delete. And so we will start off with proving something about split min. And I will start off with a suggestion what to prove. And then we will have to work on this for a bit. So this is my suggestion. And now I'm inviting comments from the audience on this lemma. Yeah.
Maybe start out with an actual T.
We can do that, but before you start out with the induction, maybe look at the statement and see if you have any comments on the statement, if you expect this to be a theorem. There's a small problem with it, yeah.
We need our notation for S.
We need what?
We need it to work for all the S's.
Oh, yeah, but that's, if you state some formula and say this is true, then you always mean it's true for all the possible values for the variable, so you don't need a quantifier. I think I know. Oh, now I know what you mean. That will come later. But that concerns the proof method. But the statement itself, let me just put it bluntly, this is not correct. Why not? Look at the definition of split min. And you don't have to look at it very hard. And now compare that with what we're trying to prove. Yep. Right. So we need to make another precondition here. We need to say if the T is not a leaf. Now, it turns out this doesn't quite work either. But now the reason is a bit more subtle. It's again a missing precondition. This will not work for all trees. Yeah? Right. So we also need that. And in fact, I think I'm slightly surprised that quick check doesn't find the counterexample, but I think the automatic quick check is just using very little time in order not to disrupt the user. And so if I explicitly call quick check, it would probably find that counterexample. No, it doesn't. Maybe there's an alternative called nitpick. This may. Yeah. So nitpick actually finds a counterexample, and if you look at the counterexample, you already spot that it's not a binary search tree because the same element, A1, occurs in it twice. So these counterexamples can be found, but the automation, the automatic test doesn't do it. You have to manually invoke them. Okay, so let's put it in there. BST of T. And now we do indeed apply induction on T, and there was a suggestion that something needs to be arbitrary. What? The X? Yeah, I didn't hear it. Yeah, X. Anything else? If you look at the definition of split min, that gives you a certain hint. Namely, what you see is you return a pair, and in the first element, the x is always the same thing that you return. That just gets handed up. But in the second element, you return a bigger and bigger tree, so that changes all the time. And therefore, when we do the proof here of this lemma, we will also need a T prime here, because we want to show it that whatever is returned for arbitrary return values, this should work. And so, of course, I could have left it out and then we would have discovered it in the proof, but it's a bit quicker if I... Okay, so now we do an apply auto and see what is left. And it takes a moment, and then we have 5 subgoals. Ooh, not very nice. Let's see. So they even we can't. They're so large. I will use a little. Is it still readable? Then I'll leave it at that. That's probably a bit better. It's still not much better. But if you now keep scrolling up and down, you'll notice that if you look at sub-goal 1, say, it's difficult to read it. But maybe something immediately catches your attention. You say, maybe we should get rid of that. Something in the goal that you want to get rid of. Yes. There's a let, but the let is inside something else that we need to get rid of first.
The if-then-else.
The if-then-else. And you, now you may be wondering, why is there an if-then-else? Isn't the if-then-else removed automatically? I didn't tell you full truth. In many cases, if you remove the if-then-else in an assumption, it leads to chaos. It leads to non-termination, whatever. So the if-then-else is only removed in the conclusion of your sub-goal. And if you want to have it removed in the assumptions, then you need to say so explicitly, and you can do so. Then you say, where are we? Auto. And then you need to say split if split assumption. So then you're telling the system, please split the if in the assumption. So this is just a fixed name of this mechanism that you have to use. When you come to a situation where you have an if-then-else in the assumptions, most likely this will help you. In our case, it hasn't really helped us. We still have 5 sub-goals. But now the case over this pair, which somebody already suggested we should get rid of, that has now sort of bubbled further up, and now it's time to get rid of that as well. So now you have to look at the slide. How did we do this? That was the prod split. But that would, if you just say split, it doesn't do anything in the assumptions. It only does something in the conclusion, and so you need to say prod split assumption. And now you've only got 2 sub-goals, so this looks more promising. And the sub-goal, the first sub-goal actually has collapsed quite a bit, and you would have to stare at it for a bit to figure out what's going on. I will give you a hint of what's going on, namely this first assumption here, that's the... Yeah, that's the remainder. That's one of the induction hypotheses, but it's been already simplified. And so it says, for all x and t prime, if x is x2 and xt prime is x2a, then this holds. So in fact, this is just a complicated way of saying, well, because this completely fixes the values of the x and the t prime, so in fact, instead of t prime and x, we can have, what is it, x2a and x2, which is completely unreadable, unfortunately. And if you keep continuing to unravel what's going on there, you find that there is a contradiction, but you don't have enough information to get to the contradiction. So, of course, it's a contradiction because you have to prove false. So it turns out when you look at it long enough, what you are trying to prove is too weak. You should be proving something stronger, and then you would be able to complete the proof. So look again at the lemma, and something stronger means you should be proving more than what's in the conclusion. The conclusion is not doesn't tell the whole story. There should be an and, you should be proving something else as well. Not just what you're trying to prove, but and something else. And now you should try and figure out what the something else could be. Okay, let me give you a hint. It's a property of X.
Well, maybe that X is the minimum.
You could try and prove that, but that's actually too difficult. That's more than is necessary. Something simpler is sufficient.
That X is in the right subtree?
Yep. Right subtree, what do you mean? And X is an element of what?
T prime.
Of T prime, yep. So set tree T prime. And now the proof has already, we have the same proof. And now we have only got one subgoal, so things have progressed. It hasn't quite got through. Why hasn't it quite gone through? And now it's just a question of limited automation. Auto doesn't try very hard, it just tries a little bit, and auto is insufficient for this. So what you now, if you were to know about further methods, then you could just say apply force, for example. Oh, or fast force, right? Oops. Oh, that's very odd. Well, then I really have to get out the hammer. See if that helps. Uh-oh. I think we're still, if none of them can do it, we're probably trying to prove something that isn't quite provable yet, because I've still forgotten something. It's now trying lots of automated proof methods, but they should be successful very quickly, but they're not. I'm puzzled. I think I will just cheat and look at the proof that comes below. Who said T prime? Thank you. Okay. And now we still have two subgoals, and now I think if I type, well, now let's get the hammer out again. Hang on, where are we? I think I need to first change over to that. Now it should. Yep. Now that's a funny behavior of auto that got introduced at some point during the years. Auto is not idempotent. If you apply it again, it sometimes proves something that you think it should have proved already. And if I apply this once more, I think it'll prove both subgoals. No, it didn't. Oh, right. That explains it. Yeah. Anyway, I'm now using stuff that I only want to introduce next week. This was an introduction to the proof process and how you have to generalize things and how you may have to look very carefully at your proof goal in order to figure out what to do next. And This was easy, only is true for the first part, for the insert and the isin test. Those were the easy problems, and the more difficult ones just need more than induction auto, and they need either more proof automation, but there's always a limit to how much proof automation you can get, and eventually we will need a more expressive proof language where we can direct the proof process better. And so what I will introduce next week is more logic and more proofs beyond pure equality. And that's it for today.